In John Turner's new book about the Pilgrims, he explains how there are years and years in this story before they actually boarded the Mayflower for their arduous journey to the New World. He tells about the religious conviction that got the whole thing started, that they had these distinctive ideas about the kind of Christian life they wanted to lead. They wanted out of the Church of England. They believed church membership should be voluntary. And so for years, they tried to live as separatists in their own homes and villages. It didn't work. So for years, they gave it a go in Holland. But finally, after all of that, came the Mayflower and a grueling 2 months at sea. Turner explains they arrived off course and much later in the year than they had hoped, and they had no real idea where they might settle or who had been there before them.
In mid-November of 1620, the Pilgrims left the Mayflower. They are frantically trying to find somewhere they can settle that will have a decent source of fresh water and arable land, and they don't have a lot of time. They've got to find a place and begin constructing houses because they have to survive the winter. And they explored various parts of Cape Cod. Picture this landing party looking like it's ready for battle. Dozen, 15 men wearing armor, carrying muskets and swords. They see some natives in the distance who run away from them. And they find graves, cornfields, caches of food. And they spend weeks exploring Cape Cod. When they finally come ashore at Plymouth a month later, they're walking into what's really a ghost town. A settlement, a native settlement, a Wampanoag settlement, that had been emptied and devastated by an epidemic. So they're coming to a place that's been emptied of people. They're going to repeople it. And they're surrounded by all of these clues about prior settlements and people that they don't understand very well.
What do they envision? What do they imagine about those people?
They certainly imagine that people are still out there who might attack them. For years, the Pilgrims are fearful of native attacks. They also imagine, as they see graves, that God has emptied the land to prepare it for them. It was very common among English settlers to presume that God had judged this land and judged the people who inhabited it and had prepared it for them.
What's the image that they have as they land for the lives they're going to create?
They envisioned a town centered around a church. They were first and foremost transplanting a church. And then secondly, they did also want to make money. They wanted to corner the New England fur trade. And they hoped that they could do that wherever they settled. But they were also ready to cast their eyes a little farther afield, establish outposts, trade, and try to make profits as quickly as they could.
Seems like it's been not masked by, but certainly shrouded by, in some ways, myth and mythology, the story itself.
I think one of the images that comes out of history is of the Pilgrims getting down on their knees and giving thanks while still on the ship. Thanks to God for a safe voyage that has brought them to this place. And no doubt they were thankful. You could almost take that as a reasonable starting point for Thanksgiving myths. But I can also imagine them looking out at this early winter landscape, I can imagine a lot of fear. There's no sense that any of the pilgrims agitated to have the Mayflower take them back home. So whatever fear and anxiety they had, they did overcome it. But it would be hard to look out at that landscape and know that you had to survive. It must not have been easy to maintain that faith.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, John Turner is our guest. We're talking about his book, They Knew They Were Pilgrims. By now, most of us have separated our turkey meal this week from the actual experience of the Mayflower passengers. The story of the first Thanksgiving has been mostly debunked. And Turner describes much of the pilgrim story as dispiriting. The religious separatists who arrived on these shores, like most all of the other settlers from Western Europe, made these treaties and alliances with the native people who were here, but then they took their land and they killed or enslaved them. As Turner puts it in the book, late November is a time for mourning, not a time for giving thanks. John Turner is a professor of religious studies at George Mason University, and the theme he follows in his book is about liberty. He told us the settlers who came to New Plymouth, the people who thought of themselves as pilgrims, shared a fierce commitment to liberty, but that they understood it in these contradictory ways. This is complicated, but Turner says the pilgrim story matters.
Their accomplishments are definitely impressive. They establish what they refer to as a body politic, you know, a political order that persists for 70 years. That is no mean feat by the standards of the 17th century. And that political order did include a significant amount of democratic participation. It was actually quite democratic at the start in terms of the Mayflower Compact, and the vast majority of adult male passengers on the Mayflower being able to elect a governor and enact laws in the years ahead. Certainly, we could qualify that in all sorts of ways. You know, women were certainly not included in the body politic. Yeah. The pilgrims had no intention of including natives or Africans in their political order. But certainly, by the standards of the day, I do think that was an impressive milestone for American democracy.
It seems like this discussion sometimes is kind of binary. You know, on one hand, people who say the pilgrims were these noble saints looking for a place to worship. On the other hand, the idea that you're getting a lot of lately, that they were in some ways hypocrites who said one thing about liberty and morality and acted another way. And it seems like one of the things you're trying to do with the book is get away from that sort of black and white perspective.
Absolutely. I don't like history as a morality play, at least in most instances. And there has been this tendency by white Americans in particular of lionizing the pilgrims as Christian saints and the progenitors of American democracy. And it was certainly overblown. And there's been a lot of pushback in recent years, partly because of a greater acknowledgement of the devastation that European colonization unleashed for the native peoples of New England. And in that respect, the pilgrims are not saints by any measure. But I think it's best to try to not, you know, depict them either as saints or as wretched sinners and hypocrites, but to try to have a sense of how they understood the world that was around them, why they did what they did. And also on the other side of the equation, to try to better understand how Native peoples responded to them and what prompted their responses. Mm.
So you say that the pilgrims didn't really inspire the founders. They weren't thinking about the pilgrims in 1620 when they started to, you know, draft a constitution or think about, you know, their own kind of rebellion. So can you say in what ways the pilgrims' ideas, you know, their religious concepts about liberty and those kinds of things. How did all of that, if it did even, form our national character that we're familiar with? Because I find myself constantly asking what it is about this country that makes us unique or, you know, different from other Western democracies. And I'm wondering, was there anything in the sort of the pilgrims that we can get a sense of American character now, or does that apply?
Well, I think the pilgrims articulated ideals and principles that did end up mattering to many generations of Americans in different places. Just a couple of examples. One of the really the key principle within the Mayflower Compact is that the validity of laws and taxes and offices rests on the consent of the people. Right. The pilgrims didn't put it quite in so many words, but as they reflected back on their compact in later years, it was something along those lines. By the end of the Plymouth Colony period, you have colonists who look back on that founding principle and use it to argue against taxation without the consent of a representative assembly. They didn't use the phrase taxation without, no taxation without representation, but that was basically what they had in mind. The thing is that that idea was not unique to the pilgrims, but they do articulate it at a fairly early date, and they do put that ideal into practice. You know, as a comparison, Virginia was granted a representative assembly a year before the Mayflower in 1619, but it still had a governor and a council appointed by a company back in London. So in Plymouth Colony, it was the in-person votes that mattered. So I think a principle like that is not unique to the pilgrims, but they were important in advancing it. In terms of religious liberty, you know, the Christian liberty for Christians to form their own congregations and to elect their own leaders, that was of paramount importance to the pilgrims. They simply did not want to grant that liberty to religious dissenters within their colony. So it was an important ideal to them, and other versions of it were advanced in other colonies and later on within Plymouth Colony. But one has to understand that the pilgrims had a particular version of it that they advanced for themselves.
You write that the book uses the Plymouth Colony as you describe it, a lens, a fresh lens for examining what liberty meant. Explain what you mean by that. Why the focus on liberty? Because this is a term you key on, it seems, and kind of work throughout the book.
Well, as I started reading the 17th century records of Plymouth Colony and the writings of the pilgrims and later colony leaders, that word appeared again and again. And what I quickly realized is that by no means did all of the folks in Plymouth Colony, let alone elsewhere, have a single stable understanding of it, but rather they had a few understandings of liberty and they debated them. They never fully resolved them. So that idea of Christian liberty that I mentioned, that is very much shared by all Protestants in England to some extent, as sort of a takeaway from the Reformation of the 16th century. But they have many different understandings of how it should be lived out in terms of what exactly does it mean for a congregation to choose its own leaders? How much power do ministers and elders have versus lay people? What ceremonies should be included as part of worship or not? So all of these are, you know, they're contested points.
Yeah.
And then in terms of political liberty and people, or at least men or a set of men, having the liberty to elect their own leaders and to enact their own laws, well, then that raises the question of who precisely should have those political privileges and what exactly does consent mean? And not only in Plymouth Colony, but the other colonies of New England in particular, the political orders of those colonies reached somewhat different conclusions about those ideals. So I see this developing contest for liberty over the course of Plymouth Colony's existence. And actually, it was rather easy to take Plymouth as a lens for exploring those debates, precisely because it wasn't an enormous place. You know, it's a relatively small number of people. We have a lot of sources from the colony's history. And so we can see those debates take shape over time.
What did they mean by liberty of conscience? Because you say religious dissenters, and I thought this was interesting. They could opt out of the formal worship, but they couldn't air their own opinions. I don't think they were allowed to create their own churches, even or even gather and talk about their own ideas that departed from the Plymouth idea of the church. Talk a little bit about how they conceived of how much freedom did they grant others.
So liberty of conscience is an interesting phrase because it essentially suggests that you don't compel individuals to do things that are against their conscience.
Yeah.
So for the pilgrims, that meant you wouldn't compel people to join their church. And in fact, they wouldn't have wanted most folks to be within it. They wouldn't have thought that everyone qualified.
Right.
You wouldn't compel people to have their children baptized. You wouldn't compel people to partake of the Lord's Supper. So in that sense, there was liberty of conscience in Plymouth, but there wasn't religious toleration in terms of dissenters being able to hold their own religious meetings. Over time, both Baptists and then Quakers contend for a greater degree of religious toleration. And in the end, within Plymouth Colony, they're successful. But there's a lot of persecution and a lot of conflict along the way, even to get to a somewhat expanded religious liberty or toleration.
We should probably, Professor, make a distinction between the Pilgrims and Puritans. I think there's this idea that the Pilgrims were somehow Puritans. Like the Puritans at the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but they weren't for the most part, I don't think, right? I mean, they were separatists. That's the proper term.
Well, they're separatists because they had entirely rejected the Church of England.
Yeah.
Which is ironic. We think of them as, you know, agents sometimes for religious liberty and toleration, but their starting point was a rejection of the established church. They saw it as just entirely corrupt, not reformed enough from the Catholic Church, and so they withdrew from it and formed their own congregations. Now, the Puritans were in many ways kindred spirits, but they hadn't quite given up on the idea of purifying the Church of England. The Separatists had fully given up on that. I think they actually did share many principles in common, and once Puritans who hadn't separated from the Church of England, once they come across the Atlantic, you know, they're sort of separated from it by geography as well. So the difference between these two groups, I think, has sometimes been overemphasized. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, though, the Pilgrims of Plymouth Colony, they did proceed in some different ways than folks in Massachusetts Bay. They didn't make church membership a test for voting rights or political privileges. And they were more keen on each individual congregation being able to chart its own course. They wanted less central religious control.
I guess this gets us to the idea of being a pilgrim, that the book's title comes from something written by William Bradford, one of the early leaders of the Plymouth Colony, and he wrote, "They knew they were pilgrims." What did he mean? Because it seems like they weren't thinking about a particular journey, more like an identity, because you say in the book that they understood their lives as this spiritual pilgrimage.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, they did not think of themselves as the pilgrims.
Yeah.
You know, they only get that title sort of in the early 1800s as later generations of Americans look back on them. But William Bradford, who was the long-term governor of Plymouth Colony, he used that phrase when he looked back on their parting from their fellow church members and friends in the Netherlands. And just to back up a little bit, these separatists had taken refuge in the Dutch Republic and primarily in the city of Leiden before they decided to establish a colony across the Atlantic. And so then in 1620, a portion of that congregation leaves the Netherlands and goes back to England before eventually boarding the Mayflower. Bradford looks back on that moment as one of great sorrow because the people saying goodbye to each other had every reason to expect that they would never see each other on earth again. And when he narrates it, he says that despite their sorrow, they knew they were pilgrims and looked not much on those things, but lifted their eyes to the heavens, their dearest country. And what Bradford was doing was alluding to a passage in the New Testament epistle to the Hebrews, whose author refers to all true Christians, really, or at least the exemplars of faith, as strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And so, to summarize, they were on a spiritual pilgrimage that would eventually take them to heaven. They didn't know where their earthly destination was. And Bradford explains that that knowledge of where they were ultimately headed helped them overcome their sorrow and their fear and their anxiety about what might befall them on earth.
You write in the book that if, for example, if you wanted to live a somewhat long life in the 17th century, it would probably be better to be in New England than in Europe. You say the New England settlers lived longer and healthier lives than those in Europe. But you also write about the reality of death in Plymouth for children and infants, for example. And there was one poet, I don't think she was in Plymouth, but Anne Bradstreet wrote that young children, you put this in the book, were like as bubble or the brittle glass. I wanted to ask you about mothers and fathers who lost children. You say they weren't desensitized to grief, that these were heavy blows. So how do they put that? This is, you know, seeing death and trying to, you know, not go overboard on grief. That I think you mentioned that they didn't believe in excessive, you know, grief or things like that. I mean, what was it like to sort of think about life and death in the moment with this, you know, grander vision that they have, but how did they act day to day when they had to confront things like grief?
Well, that's a great question. And I find those accounts of families who lost sometimes many children, sometimes most of their children, in a few cases, all of their children.
Yeah.
I find them so poignant and, you know, they can almost bring me to tears sometime. Now, the Protestants in 17th century New England, they certainly, you know, they have some beliefs that don't necessarily fit well together. They believe that God chooses whether individuals are saved or damned. And, you know, this goes back to John Calvin and maybe even farther back to Augustine. And that applies to children as well as adults. So if a child died at the age of five, according to sort of formal Calvinist theology, you had no way to know if that child would be in heaven or in hell. Now, that's a source of trauma, but a spiritual trauma. I found that certainly by the late 1600s, ministers are backing away from what's really a stark and horrifying teaching. And they are instead comforting bereaved parents with, you know, Jesus having said, let the children come to me. And they're sort of bending their theology to sort of reassure themselves that their infants and very young children will be in the bosom of Christ. They have more anxiety about their older children, maybe their teenage children, who are rebellious. You know, they don't have any assurance that God's going to automatically save them. And so older children really become a focus of spiritual anxiety in the New England colonies. But, you know, just to reflect for a moment on bereavement. Historians used to have this idea that people who lived in a time of high infant mortality became inured to grief. They weren't as attached. They knew that their children might die. Half of them died. In reality, I think each death was a harder blow. There was one settler, John Saffin, and I think all eight of his children died. He would have dreams about them for the rest of his life. These people were not just desensitized to grief. They felt each loss heavily.
John Turner, he's a professor of religious studies at George Mason University. His book is They Knew They Were Pilgrims, Plymouth Colony in the Contest for American Liberty. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the story of the Plymouth Colony and the pilgrims who arrived on the Mayflower and then left a complicated legacy. John Turner is our guest. He has a new book called They Knew They Were Pilgrims.
Let's come back to the question of liberty. And I'm wondering, what did liberty mean in the context of slavery? Because you say the pilgrims and the Puritans and everyone of that time, they were acquainted with slavery and with the ideas of servitude. So how does their concept of liberty, how does that square with the slavery that surrounded them in many ways?
Slavery and other forms of servitude were widespread, common in Plymouth Colony, especially toward the end of the colony's history, later in the 1600s. And by that, I mean both African slavery, but especially native slavery.
Yeah.
After King Philip's War, which starts in Plymouth Colony but engulfs most of the region in the mid-1670s, Plymouth Colony's leaders capture, enslave, and export hundreds of Wampanoags and other native men, women, and children. Mm. And they end up, in some cases in the Caribbean, in some cases on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, in places like Tangiers, maybe even Madagascar.
Wow.
And most Americans are not at all familiar with the idea of this form of slavery, of people being enslaved in the Americas and being taken east across the Atlantic. But it was ubiquitous in the wake of King Philip's War. And it wasn't just that war, but English settlers became accustomed to acquiring the labor of native men, women, and children, sometimes describing it and defining it as slavery, sometimes simply using the term servant. Mm. A lot of these native people at the end of the century, you know, they really toil in sort of a murky area between servitude and slavery.
Yeah, you said it was really ill-defined. And it seems like they were having these kinds of conversations in the colony. Were their Indian slaves supposed to be like the African slaves around them? Could they be bought and sold? Would, as you put it in the book, would native children inherit their mother's condition of slavery? So the fact that they were having these conversations about it and didn't really end up on any particular thing, and so for the Wampanoags or any of the native people who became slaves, they didn't know exactly how they were even thought of. It seems awful, I have to say.
Well, it is awful. Well, you know, first of all, there were African slaves in Plymouth Colony as yeah. well. Not a tremendous number, but there were, you know, I found a couple of examples of men owning five or six, which isn't insignificant. And in those instances, it was clearly understood that enslavement was for life and it was inheritable. Now, I say it's clearly understood. The colony's records don't reveal any debate on the issue, and they don't pass any laws regulating African slavery. But it seems to be clearly understood. In the case of native captives and slaves, there clearly is a lot of discussion, because for several years after King Philip's War, they pass laws and regulations to restrict the sale and perpetual enslavement of native men, women, and children. It's sometimes those laws are honored in the breach. It's clearly contested. There are native people who, in the wake of the war, clearly were made slaves for life as far as the English were concerned. And sometimes settlers would then try to claim the offspring of native women as also sort of chattel slaves. But there's a lot more debate and contest about it. And there does seem to be a desire on the part of Plymouth's leaders to primarily, you know, limit native slavery or servitude to a period, a specific period of years, and to not make it inheritable. Doesn't make it, you know, doesn't in any way make this less cruel and callous. Simply, it teaches us that slavery and liberty, they're also not just binary things in the 17th century, but there can be various conditions of unfreedom as well as various sorts of liberty.
You tell the story from 1623. So just a year or so from when they landed, where Plymouth leadership basically, as you tell it in the story, they dispatched a man named Edward Winslow and others to go and pay respects to the Wampanoag leader, Massasoit, who was sick, thought to be on his deathbed. And I wanted you to talk about this moment, because you say it gives Winslow and the others a real sense of Wampanoag religious culture and some of their rituals. What did Edward Winslow find, and what did he make of it?
So Winslow is a really interesting character among the original pilgrims, in part because he wrote a lot, and we have some of his writings, and because he took a genuine interest in native conversion, which most of the pilgrims did not. They were just trying to survive. But Winslow really had this long-term interest in missionary work to native peoples. So Winslow, he also becomes familiar enough with the Wampanoags to understand their language to a large extent. And he twice travels to visit Massasoit Usamequin, Usamequin being the Wampanoag name that at least is used later in the period. And those are some very intimate encounters. He stays in Usamequin's home. He heals him when he's deathly ill, provides medical attention in a very intimate way that, you know, Winslow doesn't find entirely pleasant. And during some of these encounters, you know, and travels, Winslow will overnight with Wampanoags in their homes. And at times they at least discussed religion. And Winslow says that at first he made a mistake. He thought these people didn't have any religious beliefs or practices, but then he came to understand that he was wrong. And in some of those writings, I think he's really trying to find points of agreement in terms of, well, we both believe in a great God. We both believe in a devil. At that point, he doesn't really, you know, doesn't seem to get too far with introducing more particular Christian doctrines to them. But he's at least interested, and he at least spends enough time with them to learn something about their language and culture. Not very many early English settlers do that. You know, they are much happier to keep at arm's length, or more than arm's length.
Come back to the idea of how they treated outsiders and what they did with people that they thought had been heretical. There's a man named Thomas Morton. I wanted you to talk about him, because his story and the way the Plymouth community deals with him is, I think, instructive about how they dealt with people who didn't live up to their ideals. Tell us who Thomas Morton is first.
So Thomas Morton is in some way sort of a ne'er-do-well who seems to flee from a marriage and maybe even a murder charge in England, which is probably might not be true. And he comes to Massachusetts Bay. He's part of a trading venture that, among other things, is going to sell English servants, indentured servants, to Virginia. But they stop at Massachusetts Bay first. And Morton organizes some of the folks on that venture who are left behind, who didn't want to be sold as servants in Virginia. Very smart move on their part. And he organizes a trading outpost. And he has a very different model for how to live in New England. He doesn't have a palisaded fort like the Pilgrims. Instead, at least according to Morton's own account, Native people can come and go. They can, you know, socialize, party, drink together, things like that. And what really causes a conflict between Morton and the Pilgrims is that Morton is a very shrewd fur trader, and he goes farther up some rivers than Pilgrim traders had been doing, and starts to corner the fur market. And so the Pilgrims decide to pay a visit to his outpost, which becomes known as Marymount. And they arrest Morton, and eventually he's shipped back to England a couple of times. John Winthrop and the folks show up in Boston, they sort of take over getting rid of Morton. But it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting contrast to Plymouth. For Thomas Morton, liberty really meant living where he wanted, trading as he wanted, you know, socializing and enjoying life as he wanted. You know, for the Pilgrims, Morton just represents licentiousness. You know, there's an old story, written about by Morton himself, of Morton building a maypole in Marymount for everyone to dance around, and the Pilgrims showing up and cutting it down. And, you know, that points to a religious conflict between the two settlements. But I think it was the fur trade first and foremost. You know, the Pilgrims, they were trying to keep their colony afloat and satisfy their investors and creditors back in England. And if Morton had gotten his way and had cornered the fur trade, you know, they were in big trouble economically. So he had to go. He was really hard to get rid of. He came back to New England on two later occasions. And he wrote a lovely book about Marymount, which is really funny because it lampoons the Pilgrims and the folks in Boston so well. But, you know, he just writes with relish about the New England landscape and its peoples.
Well, you know, Morton, and then there's Anne Hutchison. There are a number of characters who run afoul of the Plymouth leadership, want to lead their own kinds of lives, and how they fit and how they're dealt with is a really interesting part of the story. Some you mentioned were put in, I guess some were punished. I don't know if they were executed for these kinds of beliefs, but it seems to be a mixed bag, I guess, in terms of the way they dealt with people.
Yeah, no, I mean, Plymouth didn't execute any religious dissenters. Massachusetts Bay did, but Plymouth did banish people. And, you know, just a few years after the Mayflower, there were some individuals who wanted to set up something that was much more in accord with the Church of England. And, you know, they got kicked out. They had trouble with Baptists and Quakers. You know, Plymouth, their understanding was that each town should have an established church, and that church was a public good for everyone, whether or not you belonged to it. You know, you still got to sort of take advantage of the fact that there was preaching of the gospel available. They didn't want multiple religious options. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they could work out, work things out with dissenters. You know, Roger Williams, for instance, spent a couple of years in Plymouth, sort of in a roundabout way on his way to Rhode Island. And Plymouth remained on good terms with him. They just wanted him across the border in Rhode Island. They didn't want him spreading, you know, alternative ideas within the confines of the colony. In a way, they, you know, at first they really saw themselves as transplanting a single church. And over the years, people pushed back against that, and there became room for some, but not all, other religious options.
I wanted to talk about Awashonks. There are a number of really great characters, I have to say, and really interesting native leaders. Her story is interesting. We don't have a lot of time, but maybe say something about Awashonks. It's this female tribal leader, a tenacious advocate for her people, you say.
So she lives in a place called Saconnet, which is now in southeastern Rhode Island, but at the time was considered within Plymouth Colony's jurisdiction. And she becomes the leader of her community sometime around 1670. And it's right at the time that the English are pushing hard to gain title to native land, especially as you push farther west from Plymouth. And it's clear they've got designs on her people's land. Both folks in Plymouth and Rhode Island really want it. And she's just caught in a pincer. You know, she doesn't want to fight the English because she thinks that might be disastrous. But she also doesn't want to just stand by and have the English settle and deprive her people of her land. You know, and ultimately, it's not a happy story because in the wake of King Philip's War, her community does lose most of its land. And one of her sons even ends up enslaved. Nevertheless, I just admire her because for 20 years, she's able to maintain leadership of her community. She negotiates when she has to. She allies with the English when she has to. She resists some of the time. It's not a success story, but it's nevertheless a story of tenacious leadership that I think merits our respect. And it's a figure that most Americans aren't very familiar with, but Awashonks is a very powerful leader in her own right.
Well, people will wonder if we don't say something about the Thanksgiving meal myth or story. So the story that we've all come to know is pretty interesting. You mentioned how this feast or these days of feasting begins kind of by chance. William Bradford, he wanted to have some kind of celebration after the fall harvest. The Plymouth Pilgrims didn't like a lot of entertainment. They didn't approve of a lot of it, but they, you know, you say they weren't killjoys. They thought we should celebrate a little bit. So Bradford sends people out to shoot some fowl. And the shooting causes kind of a commotion. The Wampanoags hear all of this. This is where we get the story of the Thanksgiving.
This is it.
Yeah.
You know, it's in one letter written by Edward Winslow. And as you said, it's been a good harvest. I would envision this maybe being October, early October, something like that. We don't know when.
Yeah.
But Bradford says, you know, go out and shoot some fowl. And they do. And that fowl certainly might have included turkey because Bradford and others elsewhere reference you know, abundance of turkey, but it might have included geese and ducks and other things as well. And then for recreations, among other things, the pilgrim men fire their guns, maybe target practice, some sort of shooting contest. The Wampanoags hear the shooting, and they had concluded an alliance with the pilgrims the previous spring. And so 90 men, including Massasoit Usumequin, show up to see what's going on. Maybe they want to make sure their new allies aren't under attack. Right. Maybe they want to make sure their new allies aren't attacking. And when they get there, Usumequin's men shoot some deer, and they spend several days together feasting, maybe engaging in some recreations together. We don't really know. It really doesn't accord with, you know, many traditional paintings of Thanksgiving where you see native families and pilgrim families enjoying each other. And the pilgrims actually wouldn't have understood it as a Thanksgiving. They don't use the term in relation to it. It's still, nevertheless, it is, you know, it is a moment of recreation and thankfulness. Both of these peoples had endured a lot, especially the Wampanoags, over the previous several years. No doubt they were incredibly thankful to have survived the winter and to have had a good harvest. And, you know, it's not exactly the classic American myth of Thanksgiving, but it's still a pretty good moment.
Yeah. So let me ask you this then finally. You mentioned that, you know, back to the idea of a mythology associated with this story. When you strip away all of the mythology, you say there's in fact a better story. And you also talk about how, for example, like the United American Indians of New England always hold around this time a National Day of Mourning. This was a, how did you put it? It was Thanksgiving, as they put it, not Thanksgiving, obviously, for reasons that are obvious for some of the conversations we've had about the treatment of the pilgrims and native people. So what are we to finally say, do you think, about the pilgrims now in the context of all of this story? What do you make of it? And as we all sort of gather thinking about this time of year.
There is so much mythology surrounding the pilgrims, whether it's stepping on Plymouth Rock, which if it happened, it wasn't significant to them. It's maybe not all that likely.
Yeah.
The Thanksgiving, not exactly how we traditionally think about it. Simply the idea of the pilgrims coming for religious liberty, well, it's more complicated than that. But one of the things that the creation of myth often does is it obscures the humanity of the people involved. If we strip away some of that myth, we are still left with a remarkable story, very human, gritty, imperfect people who maybe practiced Christian charity with each other during that first winter, but can launch a preemptive and treacherous strike against a native community several years later. We don't need to shy away from the humanity within history. That humanity is what makes history compelling. That's what we should look to within our history, whether we're looking at pilgrims or Wampanoags.
John Turner, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
John Turner, his book is They Knew They Were Pilgrims, Plymouth Colony and the Contest for American Liberty. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.